Every team, every topic, everywhere. This is Believe.
Welcome to another episode of No Script, No Problem on the Believe Podcast Network, the number one podcast network for professionals. Do you believe? I'm your host, Steve Berkowitz. I've been interviewing fascinating and talented people from all walks of life for the past 20 years as an unscripted television producer, and before that, as a small town sports reporter. Each episode, I talk to extraordinary individuals working in nonfiction television, documentaries, true crime, and much more. If you enjoy No Script, No Problem, please subscribe, download, and rate the show. It's available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, and TuneIn. You can also find it on Believe.com and at Believe Podcast. Follow me on Twitter and Clubhouse at Steve Berkowitz and on Instagram at Steve M. Berkowitz. If you're interested in advertising on the show, please contact Believe at Believe.com. All right, let's get started. Today, my guest is an amazing independent documentary filmmaker and investigative journalist with more than 15 years of directing and producing experience. She has directed 8 television documentaries and more than 50 investigative reports. National Bird, her first feature-length film, premiered at the Berlin Film Festival in 2016 and was also selected for Tribeca, Sheffield, and IDFA. Her recent projects include the feature documentaries Enemies of the State, The United States versus Reality Winner, and the previously mentioned National Bird. Please welcome Sonia Kennebec. Thank you for being here, Sonia.
Thanks so much for having me, Stephen.
So I'm psyched to talk to you about Enemies of the State. We'll start off with that. It is a wild, wild story. I'll just kind of set up the film and then you can kind of dig in and tell me a little bit more about it. So it's a story about the DeHart family, an American family that becomes entangled in a bizarre web of secrets and lies. Their son, Matthew, is a hacker. Right? He's targeted by the U.S. government, but it gets way, way crazier than that, right? He's charged with a pretty horrible crime and you get anonymous involved there. It's wild and it's a total, you do a great job with twists and turns, which is that's the key with any great documentary. You do an amazing job with espionage and mystery. It goes over the course of many years. And you really leave it up to the audience to decide, is he guilty? Is he holding secrets that the CIA, did something horrible? And I don't want to give too much away, but it's a really exciting thriller that's a documentary. So tell everybody a little bit about Enemies of the State, how you came to do this documentary.
I like your summary a lot because it just reminds me of what we went through as a film team during the investigation, because you talk about all these twists and turns, and what you see in the film is what we experienced during our investigation. So the things that you experience as an audience when you're going through the story and experience how you see changing perspectives is what we went through as a film team as well. So this was an investigation where we did not know the outcome when we began our work on the film. The film itself, the narrative follows our own journey of investigation, our journey of research. That's why we put so many dates on the film, because we really want to disclose to the audience when we got access to certain information, which really gives you a new perspective on the story.
And that's fascinating to me that you were really following along, kind of deciding what the story was as you went. Is that scary as a filmmaker to not know where you're headed and to really be kind of making decisions in real time?
Yes, it is. It is scary, but it's also at the same time what is, so I think important when you make documentary films, that you, especially investigative films, that you go in with an open mind. And that you research in all directions, and you don't go into a story and into a documentary film with a preconceived notion of what this film is supposed to be. As a filmmaker, as a journalist, the important takeaway of this journey of investigation, this story, that it is very, very important that you go in open-minded, that you speak to all the people involved in a story, and that you are also able to, kind of adapt and shift what the story and what the film was supposed to be about. So I really think, Enemies of the State is such a good, documentary and film to also discuss the journey of filmmakers and filmmaking crews when they embark on an investigative story and really reflect on, what our own beliefs are and what our own expectations are, what we want to believe and what the reality is in some stories, and that there can be, contradictions and ambiguities in documentary film as well.
I like that word, ambiguities, right? There's a lot of nuance or a lot of feelings that come up throughout Enemies of the State, specifically about Matthew DeHart and his parents, who are kind of the main characters here. You go from, he's a hacktivist, right? He's doing something good. And he's, there's a lot of journalism that's written about him as a hero, but then he's charged with child pornography. And as a viewer, you're like, oh my God, you're appalled. As the filmmaker, how do you maintain that, we're just telling the story, you're trying to be objective. How do you maintain that objectivity?
It's really important for me when I first sit down with lead characters, people I want to make a film about, that I explain what my background is and where I'm coming from, that I have a background in journalism and I also consider myself a journalist. And when I first met the DeHart parents and we had our first conversation about their story in this film, I said to them that it is very complex. I knew from the very beginning that it would be a research rabbit hole. I probably didn't know how deep it would go and the complexity of the entire story. I definitely didn't know that, but I knew that there was a lot to investigate, a lot to research, and that it was a complex story. And I told them, if I am going to do a film about it, they have to be okay with me researching in all directions, that I'm doing my independent investigation, and that I will talk to all the people who would want to talk to me, and really, trying to get a well-rounded picture of the story. And they said, okay, they agreed to it. And that was very, very important down the road when I just, found out more and more, and we uncovered, my producing partner, Ines Hofmann-Kenna, and I, we did our research together and we uncovered the different perspectives of the Matt DeHart story. And it became clear that, we would have to give them space in the film as well, and really show the contradictions, and we did, and their family was okay with that.
It's really interesting in the film. You have the local law enforcement, right, who are charging Matt with these horrific child pornography crimes. You also have his parents who are claiming he's innocent and they're helping him flee to Canada. There's this huge discrepancy in what the story is.
For me, there was only sort of one way to tell the story, which is to have the film follow our own journey of investigation and the way we uncovered certain information. Because you see in the film how much access we got to the DeHart family. And then along the way, we uncovered contradicting perspectives. And it was really sort of unfolding, along the way. It's like an onion, kind of getting to the next layer. And we wanted the audience to have the same experience that we had. And kind of to go back to the beginning of how we found the story, a lot of it is, explains you know, sort of the opening of the film and how we get into the hard story and then start unfolding it, is that I heard about the Mata Hart case when I was still in production of my previous film, National Bird, which is about the U.S. drone war told from the perspectives of military veteran whistleblowers and survivors in Afghanistan. So I had done a story already about, you know, national security and surveillance and secrecy. So that was what I knew of the story. And when the DeHarts were explaining to me or told me their perspective of their story, it sounded, you know, it resonated with me. I'd had some of the experience they described about surveillance and the national security state myself. So that was really, really the starting point. But then when we started, you know, to go into different directions and talk to the investigators and the prosecutors, there was a whole new perspective to the story, which is so important to the full understanding of what was going on here, that possibly there were, you know, two parallel investigations going on at the same time.
Was there a point throughout the making of this film where you found any of them unbelievable, that you struggled to believe their stories, whether it was law enforcement or whether it was the DeHarts?
So much about this story is unbelievable. I really have to say that. I think that's the reason too that I never forgot about it. I've actually known about the Mata Hart story for many years, and it just stuck in my head because, you know, as you summarized at the beginning of this podcast, it has so many elements of, you know, like national security state and anonymous. And you know, we heard that Mata Hart was a WikiLeaks courier and he was interrogated and tortured by the FBI. Then there's also this child pornography case. It just had so many strange elements that really just piqued my interest, my curiosity. And I really couldn't let go of it once I heard about that story. And I really am, you know, an investigator at heart, and I read and I research all the time. So this was, in a way, you know, the perfect story for me to dig deeper into. I really didn't know, though, at the beginning of this investigation, how complicated it would be. It probably is the most complex investigation that I have ever done. And when you go along in this film and see the layers of it, it really, for me, is also a commentary of the world that we live in right now, where you have so much contradicting information on the internet, information spread so widely, so quickly over social media. And it's difficult for the audiences and people and, you know, and consumers of news and information to really decipher what is, you know, what is truth, what is propaganda. There's so many agendas now when you read information on the internet. So this film for me is reflecting on that. And I really want people to have critical thinking when they read and consume information. And that, for me, is what this film is really about. It's not just about one individual case, but it's about sort of this world that we live in right now, and where we have to continuously check ourselves and just be critical thinkers when consuming information.
When you started to kind of, as you said, peel the onion back on Matt's story and your learning about these charges with the child pornography, are you worried, you know, maybe we shouldn't be following this guy, maybe we shouldn't be telling this story, you know? Because look, I know that you're an amazing investigative journalist, but we all kind of want the perfect hero, right? Like we all want that guy or that girl. We want that person to root for, that's, you know, the Superman or the Wonder Woman at the end of the rainbow. Was there a part of you that kind of was cringing?
Well, I mean, Yeah, when you are in documentary and you do investigate these type of stories, I think you learn quickly that our lives and our world, are not Hollywood. And this film is really also about, you know, human behavior and reality, which does not follow a Hollywood narrative. And that's why for me personally, that this story in this film is so important, because it does show the complexities of human behavior, the world that we live in. It's not that simple. It's not black and white. There are a lot of shades of gray. And I, you know, especially with, you know, what we have to grapple with nowadays with, you know, misinformation and disinformation and propaganda and you know, like truth and lies, you know, and how do we even, you know, separate it? I think a big part of that too is that with all the secrecies that we have nowadays, especially in national security stories, there's also a lot of ambiguity. And we are, as human beings, I believe that we are quite uncomfortable with not knowing an ambiguity. And so we try to fill, you know, the not knowing with speculations or, yeah, just guesses of what we want the story to be. And this film actually, you know, it counters that. There is ambiguity in this. There is not knowing, and some people will feel uncomfortable with it. But I really tried to put out everything that I could find and verify, and also sort of, you know, the questions that we still have. I really hope that people, you know, will reflect on the film itself, the questions that they have, the shades of gray in it, maybe rewatch the film because it has a lot of layers as well. Yeah, I want people to think about it. I want the film to stay with people.
I love a good documentary that has incredible access. You have real recordings and transcripts. You have a lot in there. How did you go about getting this critical access to files, documents, recordings? What was that process like?
Yeah, there was a lot of time and time to research and really dig deep. So as I had said before, my producing partner, Ines Hofmann-Kenna, and I, we were researching together, and we started by reading all the court documents and going through them and also really looking at what information was missing and what directions we have to go to find out more. And then you have to structure your research in the right way, because some things like filing your own court motions, which we did with the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press, we actually filed our own court motions to unseal documents. All that takes a lot of time, same as Freedom of Information Act requests. So we did all of this type of research at the very beginning, and then, you know, we followed it up throughout the years of production. And then we did field research. We were talking to a lot of people. What you see in the film is really sort of the tip of the iceberg. And underneath, there's so much more research and investigation that we did. And what was really important for us, and that's what my editor, Maxine Gödicke, just did such a wonderful job with as well, is that we really wanted to present as much real evidence in the film, documents, also the audio recordings, you know, as we could find. Because when you have these interview partners who are just contradicting each other, where you really, as the audience, are unsure who to believe, it, you know, the tangible evidence, the documents become so much more important. So we try to include as much of that as possible for people to see. Yeah, so, you know, it really follows sort of the narrative from the point in Canada with the audio recordings. A lot of it is chronological. And then, you know, in the latter part of the film, that's where we started getting more information that we uncovered through our court motions, through more people that we got access to, which just took years, you know, of working on it and building up trust. And that's where really a whole nother perspective is presented to the audience and also to us as filmmakers.
How long did you take to make this film? And when did you know it was ready?
That's always a difficult question for filmmakers, I think. You know, when is a film ready? Because, of course, you can always continue researching. And to be honest, I actually do that. I continue researching on stories and films even after I've completed them, because they just stick with me as well. And I especially when you're left with open questions and ambiguity, you know, it just, you know, it still continues to pique my interest as a filmmaker. So I would say from, you know, the actual production until the release, it was around 3 years. I have known the story for more longer than that. So I, you know, I started reading about the story and I heard about it actually from a source many years back when I was still in production for National Bird. But yeah, the actual production time of Enemies of the State was around 3 years. And yeah, I still feel, even though, you know, we have completed it, and I think, you know, the film in itself is complete, and, you know, the story that I wanted to tell with this film, you know, in all its layers is complete, but I am still following up on it. It's definitely not over for me.
Of course not. Yeah, you're in it. That's a long time, 3 years of your life. Yeah.
When a film is, you know, complete and people experience it, you know, in these like 1.5 hours, when it's well done, I think you don't see the effort behind it. But yeah, you know, as the makers know, documentary films take so much time and effort to make. And especially when, you know, when it's independent, this was a truly independently produced film. So we worked with a very small team. I actually have, you know, really built a trusted team. You know, I've worked with my director of photography for over 15 years now. And you can see, you know, his work, I think, you know, so beautifully across our body of work. You know, he's filmed all of my independent documentaries, my composer Enzo Rudolph, who did such an incredible work on the score, Maxine Goedeke, who's just, you know, it's such an amazing editor. And this was, you know, this is a film where you can see sort of the craft of the editing when you see the lip syncing of the original audio and sort of the staging of it, which goes into all these layers as well that we use to transport the story. You know, for me, this film really is not just about one individual story, but it has these layers of what's truth, what is propaganda, people's agendas, you know, looking into how people, you know, tell a story and transport a story. So it just has so many, many layers of truth in this film, like personal truth, objective truth, you know, a memory, belief, what people, you know, strength of belief and how you transport it across film. So I do think this is a filmmaker's film. And I hope that, yeah, people who listen to your podcast will, you know, go back in and really, you know, just, you know, look at it again with a filmmaker's perspective, because it shows a lot of, you know, what we experience and struggled with as filmmakers as well in making this film.
Speaking of filmmakers, this film counts Errol Morris as an executive producer. What was it like working with the great Errol Morris?
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Errol Morris's work, and he has been such a wonderful supporter and mentor to me. He was actually already an executive producer together with Wim Wenders on National Bird. I had approached them because I wanted to make sure to secure the project. That project was a very high-risk project, you know, working with national security whistleblowers. So I reached out to them, and they really liked my work. And then when I researched Matt DeHart's story and realized that it really, this film would be not just about his case, but really about the nature of truth and memory and testimonies and, personal agendas. It really reminded me so much of Errol Moore's work with The Thin Blue Line and the way he was going so deep into all these different layers of, of filmmaking and trying to find the truth in a story that has so many complexities. And yeah, when that became clear and I saw all these parallels, I reached out to him again and asked if he would, support our work again. And he did. And he really, he said to me when he first watched A Cut of Enemies of the State, what he loved about it was that he sees that we didn't go in with sort of a preconceived notion of what this film would be, but he really could tell from the film that the investigation was very open and that, that we went where the research took us.
I'm curious about the style. There was recreations. You had to use recreations for this. Tell me a little bit about the way you shot those, what kind of a challenge those presented for you. Did you enjoy that style? What went into the recreations and how do you feel about those?
Yeah, I always wanted to use recreations with this film because, a lot of it took place in the past. So we are retelling a story that had happened, but it had so many twists and turns and also just such a cinematic storyline. When people talk about, Stranger Than Fiction, this is the story, I think, where it applies, the most. Because when you hear it or read it, for the first time, it at least for me, I thought it's like, oh my gosh, did this really happen? Is this true? This is crazy. It's really hard to believe, all the, these different events. And so I really wanted to make sure that they would be part of this film. And yeah, the only way for me to do that was to use these cinematic recreations. But then there's this other layer when, we got access to the audio of the original audio of Matt DeHart's testimony in Canada and the way he is retelling his own story. And that became, such sort of a red line in the film. It's its own, storyline, because we wanted him to retell his own story. But then there is also this element of where you are wondering about certain events that he's retelling from his perspective, how much of it is, sort of his own memory that was influenced by all the events and the things that had happened to him and his interpretation of events. So there is, this layer of him being able to retell his entire story without really being questioned. And then we have, the different perspectives of the prosecutor and the investigator who contradict some of his testimony or put it in a different type of context and perspective. And that to me, having these layers that you see in the recreations and the staging of it. And that to me tells its own type of story that really sort of blurs the line between reality and memory and fiction in a way that I could really only tell through this form.
When I ask you about The United States versus Reality Winner, another one of your fantastic films, of course, this follows whistleblower Reality Winner, who leaked a top secret document about Russian interference in the 2016 election to the media. And, you have a passion to support whistleblowers and to tell their stories. How did you gain access to this story? what made you passionate enough and, you know, to tell this story? What made you gutsy enough, really, to tell this story at a time, you know, during the Trump administration, when definitely this was not an easy story to tackle?
No, this was not an easy story to tackle at all, because there, in national security stories, there's just so much secrecy surrounding it. So it makes it really, really challenging to make films about these type of stories, because, you know, a lot of the information is secret. It's so hard and so lengthy to get access to information. And this, in the case of United States versus Reality Winner, it took us 2 years to get access to the original audio recording of the FBI interrogation of Reality Winner, which is such a crucial document and also an interesting, you know, document and this audio in the film. But it took us 2 years in a lawsuit that we had to file against the FBI, a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit, to get access to that audio. We did that with a Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press. They gave us pro bono support, and then we succeeded. But yeah, you know, the time that we invested to, you know, file Freedom of Information Act requests, appeal them, you know, file these court motions, you know, study all these court documents, that is, it's really extremely difficult and time consuming. And of course, you know, there's always a risk when you do national security whistleblower stories, which I think is the reason why they are so underreported. I mean, you know, national security whistleblowers, and they have disclosed some of the most important information of our generation about government torture, drone strikes, you know, mass surveillance, and, you know, foreign Russian election interference. So all this information was made public through national security whistleblowers, and they have sacrificed so much, but their stories, in, you know, my opinion, are not receiving the coverage that they should receive. And that really has been my motivation. I've been, you know, disturbed by how underreported these stories are. And when I first flew out to Georgia to witness, you know, first without, you know, a camera crew, when I just wanted to witness and attend one of the pretrial hearings in Reality Winner's case, I was disturbed by how, you know, few journalists, you know, were there in our little media coverage. I expected that there would be camera crews waiting outside, and that was not the case. So I called my producing partner, Ines, and I said, you know, this is, you know, there's, you know, there are not a lot of people here. And I really think that we should be paying witness to the story. And I had a really good connection to Reality Winner's mother, Billie Winner Davis. And I thought she was such a fascinating, you know, character and you know, interesting person, advocate for her daughter. And so, yeah, Ines and I decided to take on a second documentary project, you know, parallel to the production of Enemies of the State, because we felt so passionate about, you know, really witnessing and documenting Reality Winner's story.
Why do you think Reality Winner has had such a lack of coverage, such a lack of focus from the media when she was just a 25-year-old NSA contractor who did something really incredible in terms of revealing, you know, disclosing a document about Russian election interference, like in the 2016 election, and then was given the longest sentence ever imposed for unauthorized release of government information to the media. So her story really is huge. And to your point, really has not gotten that much attention. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, it's really unbelievable. You know, her story is so important. I mean, the security of our elections, the fact that she was disclosing information that then led to making our elections more secure, you know, just shows how important it was. You know, I'm showing in the film how election officials were testifying that for some of them, her disclosure was the first time they heard about, you know, threats to our election infrastructure. So yeah, why wasn't this more, you know, widely reported? I've been wondering about that, you know, for years now. And, you know, a lot of it is speculation. I think, you know, part of the reason is that that her pretrial hearings were taking place in Augusta, Georgia. So they were not taking place in, you know, Washington, D.C. or the Washington, D.C. area, where it's just easier to get to the courts and, you know, where you have more national journalists, where the investment is not so high, you know, to go out there and film and cover the story. I mean, that was difficult for us as well, you know, as an independent filmmaking team, that we always had to, you know, travel far. We needed flights and hotels. The location was, you know, made it more expensive for our, you know, independent production. And then also, I think, you know, investigative journalism is, you know, it's always such an investment. And for publications, it's an expensive investment. And, you know, you don't know the outcome of these cases. You have to, you know, send someone there. You have to follow up, you know, repeatedly on these type of stories. Then it's so difficult to get access. You know, you can't bring cameras into the courtroom. It's difficult to get access to the information, to interview partners. So yeah, these research intensive stories are very expensive to produce. And then also they silenced Reality Winner. That's the other thing. You know, she was never let out on bail. And I, when I started the story, I expected I would be interviewing her while, you know, her case was going on. And then they never let her out. I had to deal with an absent lead character. But does that mean that I should not cover the story because it's more complicated? I didn't think so. And it just challenged me more to figure out a way to tell her very, very important story and witness and document it because she was treated so harshly.
Whistleblowers with the national security angle aren't perfect characters to the national press, meaning some people in national security will say they're a traitor. They gave up government secrets, right? They're not perfect characters in some people's minds, whereas somebody like myself may say, well, they're heroes because they saw Russian interference happening and they disclosed that despite the fact that others didn't want to hear that. Do you feel like that may be a reason why some people just don't want to cover that story because it's not neat and easy and folds up into and you know, is tied up in a nice bow?
I think you are right that, you know, there's of course the criticism that whistleblowers are breaking the law. However, when we watch, you know, Hollywood films and, you know, look at sort of the disclosures of previous generations, you know, Daniel Ellsberg was disclosing information about, you know, the lives of the Vietnam War, and investigative journalists are celebrated and in movies and in books. And, you know, people like these type of stories, and they celebrate investigative journalism and the journalists. You know, I think most people in this country are for a free press. And I became a journalist because I so strongly believe in the role of journalism, as journalists having the function of holding government accountable. You know, it's an important function in a democracy. But investigative journalists, you know, we cannot disclose government misconduct without whistleblowers, people who are willing to provide information about government misconduct. And that by definition, that's what a whistleblower is. Whistleblowers disclose waste, fraud, abuse, criminal, illegal activity. They are different from spies or people who sell secrets. They are disclosing information in the public interest. So if you, as you know, an active member of our democracy, a citizen, support a free press and investigative and, you know, journalism, then I think you should also support whistleblowers. And then the other thing is, what you really see in this film is that whistleblowers nowadays are treated very, very harshly. So there are tools, you know, there are laws like mishandling, you know, government information or mishandling classified information or misuse of a government computer that, you know, where you can still punish a whistleblower without, you know, prosecuting them under the Espionage Act, which is so harsh and which is also being used very arbitrarily. You know, some people who disclose classified information get, you know, sort of a little slap on the wrist, like General Petraeus. And then someone like Reality Winner, who disclosed one single document about foreign election interference, you know, which many people believe the public should know about, in particular election officials, to make our elections more secure. So she was charged under the Espionage Act. You know, I'm presenting the information in this film, and I really think that people who watch it should then, you know, discuss and decide, is this how, you know, whistleblowers should be treated and how our democracy should look like?
Reality Winner has been released. What would you like people to know about her? What would you like to see for Reality Winner now?
Reality Winner has been released from prison, but she's still not free. She's in home confinement right now until the end of November. And then after that, she will be on supervised release for another 3 years. So she has conditions. She will not be entirely free until she receives, you know, clemency or full pardon. She actually has an active campaign going on right now. You know, her family, her attorney, her supporters, they are collecting signatures for her. There are many people who have been advocating for a pardon for her, including the former secrecy czar, William Leonard, who also speaks at the end of my film, who says that he is advocating for full pardon for her because she played such a big role in making the 2020 election more secure. Yeah, and I really hope that she will have, you know, time and peace to heal and recover, because I know that she has had a very, very difficult time in jail and then later on in prison. She was treated extremely harshly and was living under very, very bad conditions for a very long time, which you will see when you see the film and, you know, the challenges that she has been through. So I really wish her a lot of recovery and healing.
I want to ask you about National Bird, because I loved that one as well. It is a story of three very courageous whistleblowers surrounding the U.S. drone program, all involved in Iraq and Afghanistan. It was Emmy nominated in 2018 for Outstanding Current Affairs Documentary. This was one that was emotionally just gut-wrenching. Tell me a little bit about National Bird, and this was obviously kind of your dive into the whistleblower space, if you will. What made you want to take on, of all things, the drone program? You know, not the easiest thing for you to take on as a filmmaker.
Steven, you've really studied my work.
Yeah. Of course, come on. You do your research, I do mine.
I can tell. Like, oh, it makes me so happy. You know, also because National Bird is so timely still, and honestly, it will not go away. You know, drone warfare is a technology that, unfortunately, I believe will continue to spread and will be used unless we, as, you know, sort of a global community, have an established, you know, rules and regulation to, you know, guard against this type of international global warfare. And yeah, so it's been really important for me to, you know, still share this film because, you know, this year was not only the 20th anniversary of 9/11, but it's also the 20th anniversary of the first reported drone strike, which actually happened in Afghanistan on October 7th, 2001. That's according to the Atlantic magazine. You know, drone war has been in the media recently, but it's been going on for 20 years. And that's why I really needed to make this film, National Bird, because I wanted to give people insight into the technology, into how, you know, the drone war works, the human impact of it, the human impact on the people, the veterans, the military personnel in the drone program, but also people in Afghanistan. I traveled to Afghanistan for National Bird, and I spoke to the civilian victims and survivors of a drone strike gone wrong. And their testimonies are so important. And I do think that people should go back and listen to them and listen what the people have to say, the people on the ground who are most impacted by the drone war.
Yeah, that scene in Afghanistan with the victims was tough. And it's sad that we just had another very similar incident as the military was exiting Afghanistan.
Yeah. And when you watch National Bird, so National Bird really explains the problems with the drone war, you know, the distribution of decision making, how blurry and bad the images are and why. And it's, you know, and how easy it has become to use this war technology. And it's, you know, it really gives you such deep insight into the human impact. And it's really the first time as well in the film that you can, you know, people can really hear from the people most impacted, you know, deeply. So I traveled to Afghanistan. I really investigated one of the drone strikes gone wrong. And I spoke to multiple families and you know, victims and survivors and their testimonies. I mean, they're heartbreaking, but I think they deserve for us, you know, to listen to them and listen what they have to say. And it's really important, you know, moving forward for, I think, all of us to hear them as well as politicians and decision makers, because we need this information to decide if this is the way we want to live and wage wars moving forward.
In National Bird, how important was that for you to kind of put that human face on the drone program?
It was very important. And that's why when I first, you know, began research on this project, I really wanted to speak to the people directly involved, you know, not just to the press person or, yeah, the military leaders, but the people who are the actual experts who are involved in the decision making, and, you know, see who they are, how their work has been impacting them, and tell their stories. And that was also very important when I was, you know, securing the project and thinking about how can we safely discuss these issues and really educate people on how this war works. And you just mentioned Hollywood films, and what I always find, you know, when I watch shows or movies and that use this type of, you know, drone technology, is that it's very misleading, because they have these like 4K crisp images and they have all the information and people on the ground and they see everything that's going on, and that's not the reality. And that is so important for people to know. And that's why, you know, National Bird is important. That's why investigations like the New York Times investigation is important when they investigated the recent drone strike and spoke to the people, because, you know, movies and Hollywood fiction films, they don't fully represent the reality and you know, and it's important for us to understand sort of the difference. And that's why I so strongly believe in the power of documentary films and independent documentaries and investigative films and current affairs films, because they do, you know, give us education and insight into the reality of our world and what's going on and, you know, in wars and what, you know, how people are impacted.
Sonia, thank you so much for doing these types of films. I think they are critical, and I think everybody needs to see your films. So can you tell everyone where they can find Enemies of the State and United States versus Reality Winner and National Bird?
Okay, so National Bird, that is on, you know, all the major video on demand platforms. You can just, you know, Google National Bird or go on our website, you know, Amazon and all these places. Enemies of the State, similar. Yeah, you can rent it, or it's actually also now newly available on Hulu. So you can go there as well. And then United States versus Reality Winner is currently on the festival circuit. And we actually have an in-person screening, our New York premiere on November 13th and then the 15th. And I'm going to be there for a Q&A after screening. And it also has a virtual festival component. So yeah, I hope you can, you know, see that or even, you know, come out and meet me in person.
Before you go, I do want to ask. So having done now several films that deal with national security, does the government have their eye on you? I have to ask.
Well, I get asked this question quite often. You know, people ask me, are you under surveillance? And my response commonly is that we are all under surveillance. I mean, that's what we really learned through the disclosures of, you know, Thomas whistleblower Thomas Drake and Edward Snowden, is that all of our data is collected and being stored. And that's what's really important for me as well in the Reality Winner film. So, you know, of course, the Reality Winner film is about her personal story and how harshly she was treated. But one element of it, which is so important for me, for people to learn, is that as part of her pretrial hearings, her communication with her family, with her sister, with her mother and her parents, all of that was being used in court against her. That information had been stored and then it was available, and they cherry picked, you know, little parts of the information, even sentences out of her diary, and used it against her. That is really a film, United States versus Reality Winner, that is also very personal to me, because it does show how data can be used against anyone, even if you don't expect it, even if you don't do the type of work that I do. So yeah, please, people, listeners, you know, go and watch this film, and, you know, and I hope we can have a discussion afterwards about mass data collection and stores and how it can be used against everyone.
Now I'm freaked out, and thank you for freaking me out. If I ever get arrested for anything data related, anything national security related, I know who I'm calling.
Yeah. Yes, you can totally call me. Yeah. I have a lot of contacts. And and I do hope that that my films don't make people, you know, scared and self-censor themselves, because that is not what I want to do. I really think, you know, I'm inspired by the courage of the whistleblowers. And I really hope that audiences will be inspired as well, because do we want to live in a society where we have to self-censor private conversations with our family and our friends, and think about what we write down in our diary? Like, that is, I think that's wrong. You know, I do think that most Americans believe in a free society and a democracy. And, you know, like my films are there to encourage people to, you know, safeguard it and save and be courageous and safeguard our democracy and, yeah, and really, you know, speak up and speak out and support people who tell the truth.
I love it. Perfect place to end. Sonia, thank you so much for doing the podcast. This has been great.
Thank you so much for sharing and elevating my work. It really means a lot to me because I couldn't be doing it without people like you and the audience members. So thank you so much.
That's going to do it for another episode of No Script, No Problem. For everyone listening, please remember to subscribe, download, and rate the show with 5 stars. It's available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, and TuneIn. You can also find it at Bleav.com and at Bleav Podcast. Follow me on Twitter and Clubhouse at Steve Berkowitz and on Instagram at Steve M. Berkowitz. If you got any questions, email me, noscriptnoproblempodcast@gmail.com. If you're interested in advertising on the show, please contact Bleav at Bleav.com. Thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Berkowitz for No Script, No Problem.
Thank you for listening to Bleav. You can show support to your host by subscribing to the show and giving us a 5-star rating on your preferred platform. Check us out at Bleav.com and search for BLEAV on YouTube.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.